Welcome to Talking Beats with me, Daniel Lelchuk. If you like what you hear, I'd love you to give us a 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify, write a review, and if you're so inclined, tell a friend or family member. They might like the show as much as you do. Be sure to visit our website, talkingbeats.com, where you can find much more information about the guests, support the show in various ways, sign up for the newsletter, and be in touch directly with me. As always, the dialogue continues on social media at Talking Beats Podcast. I'm so glad you're here with me. Now, to the conversation. On today's program, conservationist John W. Reed. He's the founder of the Conservation Strategy Fund, a group that delivers innovative training and analytical collaborations for activists, governments, and development agencies. He's one of the authors, along with the late Thomas Lovejoy, of the recent book, Evergreen, Saving Big Forests to Save the Planet. 5 stunningly large forests remain on Earth, the taiga, extending from the Pacific Ocean across all of Russia and far northern Europe. The North American boreal ranging from Alaska's Bering Sea coast to Canada's Atlantic shore. The Amazon covering almost the entirety of South America's bulge. The Congo, occupying parts of 6 nations in Africa's wet equatorial middle, and the island forest of New Guinea, twice the size of California. These megaforests are vital to preserving global biodiversity, thousands of cultures, and a stable climate. These forests serve an essential role in decarbonizing the atmosphere. The boreal alone holds 1.8 trillion metric tons of carbon in its deep soils and peat layers, 190 years worth of global emissions at 2019 levels, and saving them is the most immediate and affordable large-scale solution to our planet's most formidable ongoing crisis. So what, if anything, can be done? How does this have any relevance to the average urban dweller of 21st century America? And what answers to the problems our planet faces lie with our trees? Well, conservationist John Reed joins me now to explain this and more. Welcome.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks for having me on the program.
Curious why you wanted to write this book. You didn't write it alone. You wrote it with the late and great Thomas Lovejoy, who was your collaborator on this. Take us through the processes of exploring initially, okay, we want to do this, and who did what?
So I just want us to note at the outset here that currently I have the pleasure of working as a senior economist at a group called Neotero. So that's my current job. And that's an organization that works with indigenous peoples who are saving forests, among other sorts of ecosystems. To go through the origins of my doing this book with Tom Lovejoy, there's some common threads that brought me into the book and into my current job. And for me, having worked for decades in conservation with an economics lens, I was seeing the limitations of the way that Western society, if I can use that term, frames environmental challenges. I came out of growing up in Northern California and being very much a disciple of John Muir and the romantic conservationists who are responsible for a lot of the environmental accomplishments in the American West. And saw that when I started working in the developing world, those narratives didn't really translate. They were not able to convince rural dwellers in South America that there should be this big, empty natural landscape we call wilderness. The landscapes were and still continue to be populated. And the challenges really were about how to integrate human and the non-human species into workable, sustainable relationships. At the same time, economics runs out of gas when it tries to get at the real deeper motivations that people have for saving nature and for caring about nature, and puts it all in instrumental terms, if you will. You know, what has nature done for me lately? What are the products that nature can churn out? Not why is the integrity of these natural systems important? Now, Tom had been working for decades on what happens, the research behind what happens when large forest ecosystems are chopped into small forest ecosystems, and had found over the course of four decades of experimentation in the Amazon that what happens is you lose a lot of species, you lose a lot of stored carbon, you lose water, and you make those forests more fire-prone. And of course, the findings of his big experiment in the Amazon have been replicated across the world as people have been able to link these biodiversity and climate aspects of forests and understand the dynamics behind these biological and physical systems. And there's one additional element, which is that when these large intact ecosystems that support distinct cultures get fragmented, those cultures get fragmented too. We lose languages, we lose native forest science, and we lose really the ability to understand deeply and over a sort of multi-generational empirical timeframe how these systems work. So Tom and I came at the question of how do we make the case for and understand the necessity of intact forest ecosystems in a way that will resonate with people and in a language that's accessible to the non-scientist and the non-specialist. Actually, we just planned to write an op-ed on the topic. And we did in 2018, and it ran in the New York Times, and we thought we were done with our collaboration. We didn't have plans to go further, but a sharp-eyed reader of the newspaper saw it and suggested to us that we explore making it into a book. So we worked for about a year together on the concept of the book, made very detailed outlines and chapter plans, and got our heads together on what was going to be in the book. Tom is on, or was on before he passed away, many different boards. He served as a special scientific envoy for several different presidential administrations. So I was always going to be the one who had time to go out and run around in the bush in New Guinea and the Congo to do the legwork for this book. But it was a great partnership, bringing together a couple of different ways of understanding the world in one package that we hoped would be a seamless product.
Talk about some of these narratives that you call the romantic narrative, some like Muir, for example, that maybe didn't translate to other parts of the world. Be a little specific. What are you talking about exactly that maybe resonated with you as a young person or resonate with some people today, but don't necessarily travel well to all corners of the world? What specifically?
The idea of nature has evolved over time in Western culture. So nature initially just meant the physical world. Then you have the Industrial Revolution, and nature comes to mean non-industrial world. So when the Transcendentalists were talking about nature in New England in the 1830s, they were talking of farms, for example, small farms were part of nature. They weren't a human conversion of nature into some other state. So when you get to the late 19th century and the 20th century, nature becomes the wild parts of the world. And what happened in the US is that the wild parts of the US were depopulated by the genocide of indigenous peoples. And then these newly depopulated landscapes were looked at by people like Muir and his contemporaries as this precious creation of the divine and something that was inspiring of deep sentiments of connection and awe. So that led to an idea of conservation in the US as being the preservation of spaces where people would be absent. And if you read, there's one of the classic texts is by Roderick Nash, Wilderness in the American Mind. He goes through this whole history, and there's barely any mention of the indigenous people who were there. So now go to some other parts of the world, like the Amazon Basin, for example. The people are still there. There has been genocide, but the idea of demographic voids is a myth. And even in the parts of the Amazon that are thought of as the most remote, the most, you know, where there are no known villages, we've been discovering over the last few decades that there are people there. And they live in voluntary isolation. They live uncontacted. And they're part of this forest ecosystem. So that's part of the difference. There's also one thing that we can...
Are you saying a conservationist like Muir, an inspiring figure to many, has no place in modern America?
Absolutely not, because the choice that we faced 130, 140 years ago when Muir first was in Yosemite and came on the scene was, are we going to privatize and pave over and industrialize those natural lands, or are we going to conserve them in parks and protected areas? And the creation of the U.S. Forest Service and the Park Service and the other federal agencies that manage land, the state agencies that manage land, if that hadn't happened, the whole country would have been divided up into small parcels and the ecosystems permanently compromised. So they were a godsend to the possibility today for us to have choices with those lands. And so now you see really interesting things happening. For example, right here in my region, California owns 50,000 acres of redwood land that was set aside in the 40s for experimentation on logging. And today, Indian tribes are saying, look, we've got sacred sites in there. Our world needs us to be accumulating carbon in those trees. There's a huge demand for people to enjoy the forest, the standing forest. They are beginning to get re-engaged in land management in interesting ways that would never have been possible if the whole thing was divvied up amongst the settlers back when.
Just to go down to brass tacks for just a moment, you write early on in the book, you plural, right? You and Mr. Lovejoy together, to keep Earth livable, we humans must grow out of our habit of transforming woods into landscapes of grass, shrubs, dirt, and pavement. Okay, so this is sort of the crux of the book right here, this one sentence. So what do you mean to keep Earth livable? We need to leave it alone. And also touch on this idea that you mention a lot throughout the book, that even one road through a massive swath of forest destroys it in a way. Why is one road so damaging even?
What happens with roads, particularly in tropical forest regions, is that the one road goes into a region for the first time, and then little roads get built off to the sides of it. In what's been described when people first saw these satellite images as a fishbone pattern. And along every one of these little fishbones, you have people settling, clearing the forest. One common dynamic is that after small farmers occupy an area for a while, larger landowners buy up a bunch of farms and consolidate them into big ranches, you get a cattle ranching economy and the fires and deforestation that you see in the Amazon today and in other forests around the world. So the road really is the vector that brings people in the first place. And it's interesting, if you read back about the first telegraph lines in Brazil, the same thing happened. So telegraph lines went into the Amazon long before roads did. And land speculators followed the telegraph lines, got into violent conflict with Indians, enslaved them, brought diseases, and so forth.
Give us a rundown of the five megaforests. How different are they? What do they look like when you're in them? What do they feel like? How varied are they? Obviously, we think that the forest in the Amazon is going to be very different from the forest in Russia, in the taiga. So how different are they? What do they have in common? How are they different?
Yeah, well, it's hard to know where to start with that. I think what they have in common is that you could start walking in one, and you can walk and walk and walk, and you can keep going. You could camp and you could walk the next day, and you could do the same thing for multiple days and still be in this a natural forest system that is big enough that species like tigers and caribou and jaguars that need big ranges have space to live. So that would be what they have in common. Now, obviously, there's a huge difference between the tropical forests, Amazon, Congo, and New Guinea, and the boreal forests, which are in a very cold part of the world. In the boreal forest, you have less species of trees. You have five or six species that make up the bulk of the trees. In the Amazon, in the Western Amazon, you can have in one 2.5 acre plot, 300 or 400 species of trees. So the diversity of the tropical forests is one of their hallmarks. Between tropical forest, one of the things that I had never been to the Congo before writing this book, and I was gobsmacked by the size of the trees and the sort of the verticality of the Congo. And you knew that among these huge trees, you also had huge animals. The Amazon is much more of a tangled weave of vines and palms, and also very large trees, has smaller animals than does the Congo. Well, it's hard to generalize about any of these places because they're so big. There are many, many forests within the forest. But one of the things that immediately draws your attention in the New Guinea forests are the birds of paradise. So birds of paradise are relatives of the crow, but they come in many, many different colors, have incredible courtship displays, and they were under a lot of pressure in the era of fashion when feathered hats were a big deal in the early 20th century. Fortunately, that went out of style, and birds of paradise have a pretty secure future. Their problem now is the loss of the forest, not the loss of their feathers. And you know, it's interesting, if you go up to the boreal forest, there are very strong similarities between them in terms of fauna, because when the Bering Strait was not the Bering Strait, but the Bering Land Bridge, species moved freely across one huge circumpolar boreal forest that went all the way from basically Atlantic to Atlantic. The same species of the brown bears we have in North America, you also have in Russia. And all the salmon species plus one you have in the Russian forest, the same ones that we have in the Pacific coast of North America.
Out of these five megaforests and five different parts of the world, very different parts of the world, Which one is most under threat right now? Which is most undergoing the biggest assault from outside forces, I suppose, meaning humans?
The Amazon, interestingly, is the most intact of the tropical forests and the most under threat. It's got a very active, what we call agricultural frontier, which is the advance of farmland into the forest on its southern and eastern flanks. And because of the weather patterns, that deforestation in the eastern and southern Amazon has huge impacts on the central and the western Amazon in terms of rainfall. So I would say that the Amazon is where things are changing the fastest. New Guinea is an interesting case because on the one hand, almost all the forest in New Guinea is held under traditional forms of land. It's not really even ownership, but land control. And that's a good thing. There's been relatively modest deforestation compared to some of the other forests, but New Guinea is the smallest of the five, and it's an island. And so that there's access to the forest on all sides. And also half of New Guinea belongs to Indonesia, which has specific plans for its part of New Guinea, which involve agricultural expansion and moving Javanese populations to colonize New Guinea in much the same way as our hemisphere was colonized by settlers in a very intentional way.
There's a chapter in the book Evergreen that we're talking about called Forests of Thought. And at the beginning of the chapter, you write, mega forests hold staggering human diversity, which is something maybe not everybody thinks about when they think of forests and they think, okay, there's not a trace of human activity, but not the case. Over a quarter, I'm continuing to read here, over a quarter of Earth's languages are spoken in the world's largest woodlands. The mere tally of languages, however, is less arresting than their particulars. Thousands of lexicons are deployed according to grammars that seem to test every possible human perception and cognition. They throw open the windows of the conceptual box within which each of us thinks, and in doing so, reveal the full spectacle of human inventiveness. What do you mean by this? Okay, yeah, a lot of people live in forests, and apparently a lot of languages are spoken, but what are the deeper levels here?
I don't know if you speak another language.
I do, a few.
Yeah. Well, you may have had the experience of trying to translate something back into English, to translate a joke from one language to the other, and it just didn't fly.
Well, actually, I was in a translation course at Dartmouth College when I was in high school. My Italian was good enough that I was doing upper-level courses at Dartmouth College, and 1 week the assignment was to translate a joke. And it's very difficult.
How'd that go?
Maybe impossible. Extremely difficult.
Yeah. So if you extrapolate from that to languages that are not just in the same family, like the ones I speak, Portuguese and Spanish, and you speak Italian, they're all have common roots with English. If you go to New Guinea, where you have over 1,000 different languages, or the Amazon basin where you have 350 different languages. In the Amazon basin, those have six major families. So families like the Indo-European family that our languages are a part of, there are dozens of them. And they just represent different ways of taking reality and putting it into words. You end up with untranslatable ideas until one actually learns those languages and can see the world from that perspective. And I think, you know, at one level, it's just cool. It's just amazing that these differences exist. And if you start to learn them, it's endlessly fascinating. From a pragmatic perspective, the languages emerged from landscapes and emerged describing what's going on in these landscapes. And not just describing as a modern scientist might do, where they go and spend a four-month field season and collect some data and then go back the next year and maybe the next year and then write their PhD. This is every day, every year, for many, many lifetimes. So the languages encode an intimacy with the environment that it remains to be seen how these knowledge systems can be brought into the mainstream of how we're trying to manage the planet. But my intuition is we're going to need them. And when you lose those languages, it's irreversible. You can't go back and start them again.
When you talk about people who live in the forest, who are really living there, you thought, okay, no one must live here, but indeed people do. First of all, how long have those people, may sound like a silly question, but how long have they lived there? Are we talking 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 500 years? Question number one. Question number two, how disconnected are they from modern life? 100%, 50%? Paint a picture.
The first part of your question, I don't know, and I don't know that there is a person who knows the answer comprehensively to that question, but there are some things that we can say. There are people who live today with, and I'll get to the second part of your question in a moment, but with practically speaking, no contact with the outside world, who have been in that situation for maybe 150 years. And that corresponds with the onset of the rubber economy in the Amazon basin, where suddenly the most remote headwaters regions of Amazon rivers, where missionaries and explorers and military men hadn't gone before, were suddenly economically attractive places to go to collect rubber, natural latex for tires and so forth. That had a devastating impact on the regions of the Amazon that had until that point been relatively undisturbed in terms of the human populations. So some of those human populations fled the rubber boom deeper into the forest. Some escaped, and the remnants of different tribes banded together and formed new groups. And then it's likely that you have groups that never had contact with European civilization. You know, since the arrival of Europeans in South America, in Brazil in 1500, for example. But there are other cases, really interesting, that I learned recently about. There's a people called the Zoé, who we write about in the book, and they were quote unquote discovered in the late 1980s and contacted by American missionaries. They did that because the Brazilian military wanted to put a road through the territory of the Zoé. And what was discovered when the Zoé were contacted is that they spoke a language that was from the other side of the Amazon River. And the Amazon River, at the point where they live, is miles wide, so they would have had no way to cross it. And they had remnants of a lingua franca that was introduced to the Amazon in the 1700s by Portuguese missionaries. So what happened was their population had been missionized in the 1700s. Then there was a change in policy in Portugal. The missions were disbanded. The Zoé took to the forest and disappeared for 200 years. With a language from a different part of the Amazon and these remnants of their being grouped with other indigenous peoples. So the people who today are out in the forest with almost no contact have a variety of different histories of how they got into that this situation of real extreme of the human experience. And as far as how much contact they have, it's usually no direct contact, human to human, no face-to-face interaction with people outside their communities. What they will do is they'll go into villages and steal machetes and cook pots. Metal is something that they really appreciate, the usefulness of metal tools and cooking implements. But that's about it.
Well, as you know, this program is called Talking Beats, and music always comes up one way or another here. And what's the music like in some of these places? Do you hear music? Do you, you've been around a lot of these wild and exotic places. Do you hear music? Do you hear drumming? Do you hear pan flutes? Do people sing? What happens orally?
Yeah, that's a great question, Daniel. And it makes me think actually of one of the origin points of this book, which was a trip that I took to a very remote area of the Bolivian Amazon. During the evening, I was sitting on the riverbank and listening. And there was this music. And it wasn't being made by people. It was being made by animals, from monkeys to birds to bugs. And it was unquestionably music. There was a timing to it. The animals knew when the empty spaces were in the timing, when they would come in. The thing about that place is that all the animals that are supposed to be there were there. It hadn't been logged, it hadn't been roaded, it hadn't been impacted in any significant way by people, and not even that much hunting. So I was thinking about that and just thinking about, the way humans make music is, I think the way humans make music and the way we make language is a reaction to our soundscape. And, we elaborate on it, we embroider it, we tweak it, we change it. But this is, I don't know if this can be proven, but it seems obvious to me that that people hear things and that they respond to them. And they respond to them in the way they make sounds that comprise language. And then they respond to them in turning language into music. When you ask about music, that's the main thing that comes to my mind and that is often forgotten when we think about the music we make, in a vacuum, divorced from the inputs from our environment. And of course, are people making interesting music in villages, singing? Yeah, everybody has music, it's part of that human tapestry of these big forests that is at risk if we lose the forests.
What's music to you in your personal life?
Oh, I listen to all kinds of stuff. I listen to classical music. I listen to reggae. We went on a road trip recently with my daughter, and she got me way into the Black Eyed Peas. So I don't have any guardrails.
Good.
And I love Brazilian music and of various kinds. A little bit of everything.
The book, is this supposed to be a wake-up call? Is it supposed to be a warning sign? Is it supposed to be purely educational, which it is? What is it that you're trying to do here with the book, and what can we sort of ordinary average citizens of the United States do? A lot of people who live in the United States will never set foot in a forest in their lives.
Well, first of all, I would say that most people in the United States have the opportunity and should do it. And the first objective of our book was to enchant people and to make them feel a bit of the magic of the extraordinary places that we write about. We make clear at the end of the book that you don't have to go to deepest Congo to interact with trees and the other parts of a forest. You can go someplace nearby. And for many, many people in my line of work, the gateway experience to working in the bigger world were things that happened to us in our backyards or close to home, that opened some doors of curiosity and awe. So I would say our first recommendation for the individual is, if you were interested enough to read the book, we think that you probably would have a good time out in the woods and just connecting with life. But then there are things that we can all do in our daily lives as consumers to make a difference. It's not true that our decisions are too small to bend the curve of climate change. And we make the case in the book that our economy is a dance between producers and consumers, between companies and individuals and policymakers. And our part of the dance as individuals is just put as few demands on our planet as we can. So if we use less energy, we're going to be having a direct impact in two different ways on the megaforests. We're going to be asking them to accept less oil and gas wells, less biomass plants, burning wood to make energy. And we're also going to be keeping the temperature at a level that nature can have a better shot at adapting and preserving some of the biodiversity that we have now into future centuries, when hopefully we've gotten through this sort of extraordinary moment we're having environmentally and are able to manage ourselves and the planet better.
The last chapter in the book is called An Invitation, and it opens with a conversation with this Tama Zaimba. Is that how to pronounce it?
Yeah.
Talk about this person and his importance to you. Who was he? Where did this wisdom come from? Where'd you find him? Where'd you meet him?
Yeah. Well, he became a friend in the last few years as in my my job. I began working to support the stewardship of a massive forest called the Javari Valley in Brazil. And the Javari Valley has five or six different contacted tribes, and it has a dozen or so groups of uncontacted people. And the guy called Tama Zaimba in the book, who also in public life in Brazil goes by Beto Marubo, he grew up in a tiny village. He didn't speak Portuguese until he was a teenager. And he was sent out by his family with the mission of interacting with the world of white people. He learned Portuguese, he joined the army, he got training, he came back, and he's dedicated his life to protecting his territory. And he is a really unique guy in that he's an indigenous person who's been at the forefront of the protection of the uncontacted tribes. And he has very moving ways of talking about doing something for somebody, speaking for somebody in the public arena who will never even know that he exists, who will never even know what the public arena looks like, or that his fate may be decided there. So we met in the context of work, and he's just become a close friend and a person who's deeply embedded in the world of the forest, of the Javari. That's who he is and where he comes from, but is an incredibly articulate spokesperson who can do that translation trick we were talking about earlier to make us understand what's going on there. And the passage is funny because he's not a Christian, nor is his father, but they're sort of reading the Bible like it's, you know, a National Geographic that showed up in their village, and talking about what the story of paradise means in their culture and what we are doing to it as a species.
How well are we doing right now? How much of a difference is an organization like yours, or the multiple organizations with which you're involved, how big of a dent are those having? Are we doing terribly? Are we doing medium? Have we started to turn around from the damage done maybe, I don't know, 50, 80 years ago, 40 years ago? Have we turned a corner?
I think about when I first went to Brazil in 1991, and deforestation at that point was called land cleaning. There was no concept in the public discourse that getting rid of forest was a bad thing. There were some biologists who were talking about it. Their voices were not being heard. And there was no infrastructure for protecting the environment. But I say no, very little. So for example, Brazil is made up of states just like the US. None of the states had environmental agencies back then. Now they all do. They had very rudimentary environmental regulation and protected areas capacity at the national level. Now they developed a very sophisticated set of agencies that the current president has done his best to disassemble. But Brazil, between 2004 and 2012, reduced deforestation by 80%. That's something that no country in the world has ever done. And it's a demonstration that the right combination of policies and programs can tackle this problem. You asked a complicated question, how are we doing? We have come a long way in terms of the understanding of the importance of forests. More recently, the understanding of forests for our climate. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says we can't get to a livable temperature of under 1.5 degrees hotter than pre-industrial temperature without stopping and reversing deforestation. So there, the consciousness is there, the infrastructure, trained people, the science. We're able to look at the forest with much more precision now in real time and see what's happening. I think where we're not turning the corner is just simply human society's ability to adapt to our times. Our times require a different kind of way of operating, a different place for markets in our societies, and a different concept of how nations and jurisdictions at all levels collaborate and do something out of a sense of obligation to the only planet that we know about that has livable, that is livable. So that's where our biggest challenge is. It's not a technical challenge. It's a challenge of adapting to the times that we're in and the mess that we have created.
Do you think national borders need to fade away when it comes to something like this? Is that part of what you're talking about? I mean, do we have to drop the idea of delineating different politics in different countries in the spirit of naturalistic / political cooperation?
That's above my pay grade. But people have struggled with the idea of, in order to tackle very, very big problems, do you need a very, very big authority structure? Do you need the Leviathan? Do you need something that is going to benevolently govern at a global level or at a very large geographic level in any case, and do what needs to be done? It's probably, I don't know the answer, and it's a theoretical question in any event. I do think, though, that, you know, the U.S. National Security Assessment just came out, and I haven't read it yet, but the news that the reporting on it says things like the biggest threats for the U.S. are China, you know, not so much Russia, but it still frames this as a competition between countries, you know, a competition between countries and a sort of a contest to maintain a stable status quo. Well, that contest between countries for material well-being is sinking the ship of the planet. And the idea of maintaining a stable status quo is a status quo that entails continued carbon emissions. So I do believe that we need a mindset in which the countries look at each other differently and get on board with the idea that we're all in one boat. And we don't start rowing in the same direction. We're all going to suffer.
You sound pretty optimistic. I think overall, compared to some other climate people I've talked to, which is great and very much appreciated. The book's done. The book is published out. Are you writing something else now? What's your big challenge right now, short term?
Well, I think right now, short term, is just to continue to talk about the role that intact ecosystems, and in particular, intact forests play in the health of our planet and the health of our societies. And it can't just sort of be put the message in a bottle and throw it in the ocean. It's something that needs to be repeated over and over again so that people get the message. But I am very interested in the question of how this cultural diversity and how languages can be part of our solution set and need to be preserved vigorously, because that's one of their, you know, languages are more endangered than species at this point. So that's an area that I'd like to bring more awareness to. Bring awareness to, you know, I want people to continue to be concerned about what's happening and marvel at what still exists. I would like to write more about the marvels of what still exists as a, you know, kind of like the energy drink of action that gets people to get stoked and do something about it.
I love it. Well, there's no better way to get stoked than to appreciate what we have, whether it's a symphony of Mozart or a natural landscape or a painting of Vermeer. Whatever gets us stoked, meaning excited, mm-hmm. and lights the fire, I think is important. And when you do more with languages, and when you do more with getting people stoked and igniting the passion and the marvel, please come back and talk to me. In the meantime, the book I have here, Saving Big Forests to Save the Planet, Evergreen. John Reed, it's a great pleasure to have you. Indeed, I thank you, sir.
Daniel, thanks for having me on. It's been great talking to you.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with me, Daniel Lalchuk. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and write a review if you would. That really helps. The original music for this show is by Ronald Markham. For more information, visit the website of the show, talkingbeats.com. Thank you for listening. This is Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk.